everybody. Welcome to our podcast, Cow Dust and Cattle Country. I am your host, Laura.
And I'm Carolyn with Ranchers Have Rights. Laura, we were trying to think about what has been going on this past week, and we've both been so crazy busy. Easter was just 2 days ago.
I know, and I already forgot we had Easter 2 days ago.
But we had a great time. We got to go to the sunrise service, and the grandkids were there, and they sang in front, and then we had a nice brunch breakfast with everyone, and then they hunted Easter eggs, and it was just a great celebration of Jesus rising again. So cool. I cannot complain about that.
No, sure can't. I'm a little jealous that you're closer to church than I am, because all I had on Easter was a bunch of people on Facebook putting up Easter blessings. And, you know, that's really kind of fun, because Facebook is kind of full of strife and people arguing and blah, blah, blah. And then you can open it on Easter and there's nothing but messages of the resurrection. It's just kind of beautiful.
Yeah, it makes you're not alone, are you?
Right. It makes you feel like you're not alone in the world. And there's a lot of people out there that even if they don't get along with each other, they still love Jesus.
Yeah, don't worry about anything. Pray about everything. So,
yeah, right.
Anyway, we have done a lot of worrying about this podcast, so maybe we need to pray some more. Dear Lord.
Help us not to mess it up.
No kidding. Lord, we respectfully ask that. So anyway, we got a good topic this week. It's on the Endangered Species Act.
Now, whether we can do it justice or not, I'm not really sure. There's a lot to cover, but we're just going to hit the high points and talk about what's going on in Congress and, you know, let you guys email us if you want any documents or need any information. Does that sound good?
That sounds like a great idea. Why don't you start off by reading? Do you have it right there in front of you, what Representative Bentz from Oregon has said this last week?
Today, the Subcommittee on Water, Wildlife, and Fisheries held a hearing that started the examination of the Endangered Species Act, including any improvements that can be made to help species, habitat, and people. Subcommittee Chairman Cliff Bentz, Republican, Oregon, issued the following statement in response. 2023 marks the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. Today's hearing was the first of a number of hearings in the subcommittee that the subcommittee will hold on the Endangered Species Act. It focused on the need to delist two recovered species, the gray wolf and the grizzly bear. There is no doubt that the bills discussed today need to pass. For too long, those in urban areas have used the Endangered Species Act to promote policies that are harmful to rural areas like Eastern Oregon. This simply cannot continue, and I am proud to say that today we took our first steps in assuring the ESA functions as it should, to protect species while not harming communities and the people who live in them.
There's that word again, protect.
Right.
And when we get into what I have found, it is about protection, but wait till we get there. It's going to be about protecting us against insects. Can you believe that? The whole Endangered Species Act is based on protection against the boll weevil.
Wow.
So I do want to say, because we were looking at, you and I read one of the bills. I think it was H.R. 1142 to require economic consideration, impact in making delisting decisions.
Yeah, that's the one we read. And for those of you who don't know what it is, these are some of the bills that the representative from Oregon were talking about. There are two of them, H.R. 518 and H.R. 1142. So if you want to see those, give me an email or text me and I'll email them to you.
The economic impact, I've not understood why, because it says in the section on the Endangered Species Act that the secretary may make further requirements for a showing of undue economic hardship as he deems fit. And basically what the H.R. 1142, if I read it correctly, basically what that does is it describes what the economic hardships can be to the community or to businesses. I don't know that anyone's ever used the undue economic hardship to have a wolf removed from their premises. But I'm glad that they see it. So I hope we can get some protection.
Well, maybe all those letters you've been writing to them talking about it gave them an idea.
I'm just going to pretend they did, Laura.
You may as well. You've been doing a lot of work. You may as well get something out of it. And I do think they read their letters. I do. Have you gotten any letters back?
You know, what's sad is I did get one letter back from the forest supervisor just saying that we didn't have any valid existing rights under our grazing permit.
Oh, really?
So that was kind of a sad deal. But.
Well, you know, they've never thought that. No. They don't even listen to the Supreme Court, so what are you going to do?
Laura, how does it get decided what is going to be an endangered species?
The Endangered Species Act requires that listing determinations are supposed to be based on sound science and commercial information, the best information available. Economic impacts are not considered in making listing determinations and are prohibited under the ESA. Did you know that?
No, but that would change completely with this bill, wouldn't
it? Right, it seems like it would. So under the Endangered Species Act, a species must be listed if it is threatened or endangered because of any of the five following factors. 1, present or threatened destruction, modification, or curtailment of its habitat or range. 2, overutilization of the species for commercial, recreational, scientific, or educational purposes. 3, disease or predation. 4, inadequacy of existing regulatory mechanisms. And 5, other natural or man-made factors affecting its continued existence. That's just about everything.
You know, what caught me about Representative Bentz was he said in his rural Oregon, there was 30,000 people who lost their jobs. And these would be the loggers.
That's unbelievable.
Yes, and now the forests are burning.
Yeah.
So these people lost their jobs. The forests are burning because they're too thick.
Mm-hmm.
And we all knew that was going to happen. Like he said, he really caught my attention because he says, we're not here to remove the Endangered Species Act. We're here to improve it.
Right, and it has not been improved for over 35 years, and this is its 50th anniversary. So it's time to look it all over, and we have enough data and education about it now to know what's working and what's not working. Let me tell you, what's not working is the pressure it puts on small rural communities compared to people who don't live out here. So it's kind of implemented inequitably.
And what's so sad is we've been feeling the impact, like the rural town reserve, they felt it in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Their school district, I think, was one of the wealthiest school districts in New Mexico, one of the wealthier ones. And it dropped it dramatically when the logging industry left.
Right.
And
yeah, their entire tax base was just decimated.
Right. The tax base, that's a whole other issue in itself. But people are finally noticing now that they're being affected with the smoke every summer. And so we feel the effects immediately when they put wolves on us. We feel the effects immediately when they say we can't use the water because of a snake. We feel the effects immediately. And it may take 2 decades before people who are downriver to feel the effects. So I think the 2, 3, 4, 5 decades have come about, and now people are feeling the effects of this.
Right. And you know, did you know that in 50 years, how many species have actually been delisted from the Endangered Species Act?
How many have been listed first?
Oh, hold on. Okay, here's this. As of September 2022, there are 2,368 species listed under the Endangered Species Act, with 1,673 of those species located within the United States. Now, why are they listing species under an American law that are outside of the United States? I don't understand that.
You will understand that in by the end of this conversation.
Okay, good, because you need to teach me about that. And about 750 of those species have been listed due to the Center for Biological Diversity's legal action and citizen petition. Now, that's just one environmental group. Here's the fun part. In total, over 50 years, 54 species have been delisted from the Endangered Species Act due to recovery, and another 56 species have been somewhat downlisted from endangered to threatened. I don't think that's a very good track record.
No.
That's a species every...
Out of 2,200,
yeah,
we've got 50 that have been saved.
Right. I think it's about time that they revamp the thing and make it work for everybody a little bit better.
Yeah, it's not saving when the forests are burning, and then
right
when you have pictures of your land being washed away because of the burns, it is not working.
Well, there's two ways which a species can come to be listed or delisted under the ESA. They receive a petition from a person or organization requesting that they list a species as threatened or endangered, or they reclassify a species or delist a species. So there's various petitions to get them on or off the list. And then number two, they voluntarily choose to examine the status of a species by initiating their own status review of a species. The process to delist is the same. They have to meet all of these scientific objectives and go through NEPA, and it can be pushed out as the agency deems fit, and they can wait for a delisting petition and just not do anything on the delisting petition for as long as they want to. And that's another thing one of those new bills would change. They would have to give equal priority to delisting petitions as they do listing petitions, from how I understand it. So that would be a great thing to have happen too.
So once again, it's who can be organized and send in more petitions.
Right.
That gets more attention than those who are out not sending in petitions, because that is not their goal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cottage industry for sure. And of course, they get their court cases paid for every time they list a species. Fish and Wildlife Service ignores them for a day or two longer than the 90 days they're supposed to take, then they get their court cases paid for. Just real quick, let me talk about delisting. How hard it is to delist something. Do you remember what happened when they delisted the wolves up in the northern part of the country? Immediately the lawsuits were filed. I mean, they had a listing and recovery plan that was supposed to allow for 150 wolves in throughout the Northwest, in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and all of those states. And then when it came down to it, they couldn't delist it. And finally, after like three lawsuits, listing, delisting, listing, delisting, they finally got it delisted. Unfortunately, by then, the population of wolves was in the thousands. So where's the limit? There doesn't seem to be a limit to get anything delisted. It's really kind of just arbitrary just to, you know, allow these things to just never come off the list, it seems like. So getting something delisted at an even keel with listing is pretty important, in my opinion, because it kind of takes the burden off of people. But right now, just in Idaho alone, since 2019, the Idaho wolf population has been stable. The Game and Fish Department estimates there to be about 1,543 wolves. As of 2021, the number exceeds the minimum federal criteria of 150 Idaho wolves.
And Idaho, 1,000 wolves.
I know. Can you imagine having that here?
I can imagine it, and it's not pretty.
Yeah, I know.
But why didn't they get to delist if the requirement was in the hundreds? Why didn't they delist at 200? They let it go out of control.
Right. Sue and settle. Sue and settle. It's a cottage industry. It's all about the economics of suing for the endangered species listing and settling and making money. I can't see that having over thousands of wolves is good for the landscape, good for the other wildlife, or good for the ecosystem. But that's how we're dealing with things now. So, yeah, well, tell me about what you've learned in the history of the Endangered Species Act, because that pretty much covers what I know, other than my personal experience, which isn't good and nobody wants to hear it.
In 1900, there was an act called the Lacey Act, and it banned trafficking in fish or wildlife or plants that were illegally taken or possessed or transported. So we need to think about federal law and state law. And federal law is national, of course, and it covers when things cover state lines or cross state lines or for our protection is federal law. Mm-hmm. And state law covers wildlife. When you think about it, wildlife should be under the state. But to make it so it could be federal, the very first act was called the Lacey Act, L-A-C-E-Y, and it was enacted in 1900. Mm-hmm. And it is a U.S. law that bans trafficking in fish, wildlife, or plants that are illegally taken or possessed or transported across state lines.
Okay.
So that sounds good, doesn't it? So if you take and shoot an elk in Arizona and you take it across the state line, who should cover that? Well, that's where the federal government steps in. But in 2008, this is kind of a sidetrack, but in 2008, the Lacey Act was amended to include a prohibition on trade in plant and plant products such as timber and paper harvested in violation of, now listen to this, harvested in violation of foreign law.
What?
Yes. Now that's, I'll explain more, but our timber is being monitored under foreign law.
I don't understand.
Okay. So in 1913, there was Senator McLean, and I think he was from Connecticut, and he wanted to protect migratory and insectivorous birds. And what that is to protect the migratory birds that are a common defense against crop-destroying insects. So the birds that eat insects.
Okay.
And he says it is not possible for each state separately to make proper protection. There's that P word again, protection.
Yeah.
And therefore, the nation must take a hand and enforce a long dormant right. And he said, a federal law for the protection of birds, he maintained, is constitutional. This was in 1913. Its constitutional is determined not so much by the power of Congress to regulate interstate commerce, but as in the power to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare.
Okay.
So how is protecting the common defense and promoting the general welfare? How do you do that with a bird?
I don't know.
The protection, this is something, the protection of the nation against insects, boll weevil, gypsy moth, army worm, will be as necessary and justifiable as it is now the protection of the people against contagious diseases and hostile fleets. The original Migratory Bird Act was to protect farmers and their food crop.
Okay. Well, it makes sense to start with, but how did we get where we are now? Because now we're not protecting farmers at all.
No. And you had to do a search because in the newspapers, it would say protection on the migratory birds. And it didn't always talk about the insect. I bet the general public thought, oh, we're protecting the birds. Those who were in the know, maybe the farmers in the Midwest, thought, oh, they're protecting our farm crops. So that was 1913, and that was an act to protect the migratory bird. Well, come to find out, it's illegal. It was an illegal act. Sorry, it went between two state rulings and two Supreme Court rulings, and it was unconstitutional. So then what they did was they made a migratory bird treaty with Canada. A treaty becomes the law of the land.
Yes.
So even though it is unconstitutional for the federal government to make rules about wildlife, once it becomes a treaty, it becomes the law of the land.
And they can do whatever
they want.
So
you had
want.
Your migratory...
Even if it's migratory, unconstitutional?
Even if it's unconstitutional.
Huh.
And so since they got the treaty in 1916 with Canada, in 1918, they made the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So now it's legal.
Wow.
Yep.
I'm looking at your page right now, and you've got a clipping on here that says migratory bird laws upheld by the United States Supreme Court. So they went all the way to the Supreme Court with this. At first, the Supreme Court said, nope, it's not constitutional. You can't do this. So they went ahead and changed it from a law to a treaty. Wow.
Yeah.
Learn something new every day.
They called it the Defunct Bird Act. Crusaders now inform us that they always knew the Migratory Bird Act of 1913 would not stand the test of the United States Supreme Court, and that it was necessary to frame new federal legislation based upon a treaty with the foreign government in order to render valid certain unconstitutional legislation contrary to the foundation principles of our republic.
I don't approve. Well, I had always heard that the Endangered Species Act was based on a treaty. And that's probably the treaty, right?
Yes.
And that's what made it possible for them to run ruckshod over all of us all these years.
Right.
Against that's people who are producing their food and trying to produce fuel and make life easier for Americans. And it's completely unconstitutional. But because it's put together under a treaty with a foreign country, it's allowed.
That's right. Isn't that something?
That's nice work if you can get it.
Well, it's right here on my rancherswherights.com, and it's on the Endangered Species Act. Do you want to read that, an early warning against the implication?
Sure, let me find it. Okay, what they've done there is called absolutism through treaty. Okay? And I guess it was in the Supreme Court in Missouri versus Holland, a case in 1920. And that pretty much outlines the history of the case that began in 1913 with the passage by Congress of the Weeks-McLean Migratory Act declaring certain migratory birds to be within the custody and protection of the government of the United States.
Two state and two federal courts held this act unconstitutional, maintaining that power over the birds was vested solely in the states. In 1916, the Department of Agriculture urged the State Department to conclude a treaty with Canada protecting migratory birds, and this was promptly done. Now remember, we said this protection was so that those birds would eat the insects
and protect the farmers who were producing the food.
Right. But we don't hear about protecting the farmers when we can't use our waters, do we?
Right. And you can't graze, and you have to flush every bit of the irrigation water down into the ocean in California. In 1918, Congress enacted the Migratory Birds Treaty Act, and this is what was declared constitutional by Justice Holmes. The treaty covered much of the same ground as the Weeks-McLean Act of 1913. Thus, says Professor Black, by virtue of the interposition of an underlying treaty, an act that standing alone is manifestly unconstitutional now passes the gauntlet of judicial review and becomes the law of the land.
Well, what do you think about all that? Unconstitutional and
I don't approve of this.
Of the land.
I don't approve of this as an American citizen. It's kind of a backdoor entry into getting control.
Yeah. And it's putting whole communities out of business, and it has not protected our forests. Justice Holmes maintained that this outcome was possible because while legislation by Congress must be in pursuance of the Constitution, treaties need only be made under the authority of the United States. Thus, he contended that the provisions of a treaty with effect as internal law need not be controlled or governed by the Constitution or pursuant to its terms. Well, Laura, that's why I just had a thought while I was reading. We have an agreement with Mexico on the Mexican wolves is because we have to have it to be international. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Here the justice was obliged to do violence to the intention of the men who drafted the Constitution in 1787. They used the phrase under the authority of the United States for a deliberate but limited reason.
So if you want to read all of it, go ahead and go to Ranchers Have Rights and then the Endangered Species Act. But I will say that there's one line that I think we should read, and it says, by this decision, the treaty power became a loophole in the doctrine of limited government, and the president and the Senate, if so minded, can avoid all of the safeguards carefully erected to protect individual right and prevent arbitrary acts of government. Our individual rights are not being protected, and that's my website. On the bottom of each page, it says protection for the rancher is the law. And I am continually asking, where is that protection? It's not in the Endangered Species Act.
Right. It's certainly not. It's just not there. And the Endangered Species Act has a Section 7 that requires them to consult with other agencies, and it forces those other agencies to implement the Endangered Species Act over everything else. So because we have a little bird treaty and a little Mexico treaty, we no longer have rights out here or anywhere. Actually, anywhere in the United States, they find a little bird or a snail darter. I don't find that acceptable.
No, and I will say that you can't list insects. That comes from one of the beginning ideas that the birds are to protect us from harmful insects.
Wow.
Yeah, it says that the term endangered species, except for the class Insecta, determined by the secretary to constitute a pest whose protection under the provisions of this act would present an overwhelming and overriding risk to man. And that was in Section 3 of the Endangered Species Act. So they have thrown in there just through one line. And if you don't know about the history, you wouldn't probably recognize it. But they are protecting us from the boll weevil and the army worm.
Yeah. Until later when they decide not to protect us at all. Unbelievable. So here we are, the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act, and we're going to see a lot of pushback on trying to get any kind of revamping of it done to give people back a little bit of protection, just the tiniest bit of protection. So anyone who needs to read these two bills, Congress is trying. If you get onto C-SPAN and watch this subcommittee of Water and Wildlife and Fisheries, they are scrappers. I mean, a lot of them are being given the term rhino right now, and maybe it's deserved and maybe it's not. But when you watch them on C-SPAN debating and discussing and questioning, they are absolute scrappers for rural America. And you kind of got to take that into consideration when you're, you know, discussing politics. But H.R. 518 is a bill that's in that committee right now, and it's to require the publication on the internet the basis for determinations that species are threatened and endangered. They don't have to do that now. They can just decide. They may have to go through and read whatever science is out there, and if it meets their agenda, they'll use it. If it doesn't meet their agenda, they won't use it. But we can't see what they did choose to base it on. And then they, of course, have to go through the NEPA process and get public input and blah, blah, blah.
I kind of think their agenda is, how much will this hurt the rural community?
It's looking that way. I mean, we can't always think that way, but it kind of looks that way.
Yes. Do you have anything against saving any of these frogs or against saving these snakes or against saving the birds?
Not really.
Not really. Until they put us out of business to do it.
Right. And that seems to be the goal, is to use it to control the rural population, which is absolutely ridiculous. How are people supposed to survive without your rural population? So another thing that H.R. 1142 is another bill, and it's to require economic consideration impact to making listing decisions. If anybody needs to see these bills, shoot us an email, wildcowtrails@gmail.com, and go to Carolyn's website, rancherhaverights.com/Endangered Species Act, and you can see where we're coming from. Give us a call. Oh, we have a Facebook page. Go look for Cow Dust and Cattle Country on Facebook and join us. We'd love to have you, and it'll give you direct access to the podcast as we get them done.
Yes, thank you. And remember, ranchers have rights.
Yeah, see you next time.